Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, February is American Heart Month, and since there can be a correlation between heart disease and stroke, today we're dedicating the whole hour to the subject of stroke. It's something that's not talked about very much, and yet it's the third leading cause of death in the USA. On average, someone in the USA has a stroke every 40 seconds. And for those who do survive a stroke, it can be extremely debilitating. So we'll begin today by talking with recognized neurosurgeon Dr. David Langlois, who will share the latest medical information on strokes. Then we'll take a more personal look at life pre- and post-stroke with stroke survivor, researcher, and writer Steve Borstein, who's written a book called Different Strokes. And we'll round up today's show with stroke survivor and neuropsychologist Dr. Diane Roberts. She works with a lot of stroke survivors. She's written a book called Coping with Mild Brain Trauma. And she's going to share what neuropsychology is, how it can help patients cope while they put their lives back together. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. David Langlois. He's the neurosurgeon at the Cushing Neuroscience Institute, part of the North Shore LIJ Health System in Manhasset, New York. He's the director of cerebrovascular research at North Shore University Hospital and associate professor of neurosurgery at Hofstra University School of Medicine. And Dr. Langlois is recognized for performing cutting-edge, groundbreaking surgery. He's also a frequent media expert consultant. Dr. David Langlois, welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate you being with us today. You know, as a writer myself, I'm always curious about the origins of words. And stroke seems such an innocuous word for an event that can be so damaging and even fatal. So I looked it up and saw that what we call a stroke today used to be called apoplexy, derived from the Greek word apoplessin, meaning to strike down, and suddenly it made more sense to me. But a stroke is also known as a CVA, a cerebrovascular accident. So tell us, if you would, let's start there. What does that mean?
Well, there are really two. The origin of the word is because it would sort of hit somebody suddenly, and no one could sort of understand what caused this. It's been around for, you know, obviously probably since the beginning of human beings. It's become more common as people age because strokes occur in older people more frequently, younger people. We're seeing a significant portion of strokes in younger adults and people less than 50. There are really two kinds of strokes, at least on the brain side. One that actually there's a hemorrhage in the brain, and then one what's called a non-hemorrhagic or an ischemic stroke, where you just get a blood vessel blockage. But they both can manifest similarly, and that they both can cause a brain injury. If you block a vessel off to the brain, that whatever brain is subserved by the blood flow from that vessel, that brain is at risk to die, depending on the way that the brain's able to sort of get around that blockage or not. Whereas a hemorrhagic stroke, when you actually hemorrhage into the brain, you know, that blood causes an acute injury, and just primarily just from like tissue trauma. And so they're two separate types of causes, but can often manifest in a similar way.
Okay, so you say they often manifest in a similar way. Is one of them more dangerous to the patient than the other?
I suppose if you had to, you know, push someone on it, you'd say a hemorrhagic stroke is probably somewhat more dangerous as far as, you know, immediate life or death, because if you bleed in a bad place, you can, you know, there's the mass effect from the hemorrhage that you die from. But either one can be dangerous. I mean, an ischemic stroke, if it's large enough, can cause you to die. And if it's in the location of the brain that has to do with wakefulness or the types of parts of the brain that make you sort of awake or alive, then you can certainly die from an ischemic stroke. I think in general, life or death, as far as just pure life or death, there are probably more deaths from hemorrhagic stroke. But as far as quality of life and the impact that a stroke has on you or your loved one's life, that they're probably equivalent or potentially even worse to have an ischemic stroke.
Mm. So let's look at some of the symptoms, some of the warning signs. I go back to, you know, several years ago when my uncle had a stroke, and he'd come back from the doctors and the doctor said, no, there's nothing wrong with you. His wife, who'd been a longtime nurse, went, get back in the car, I'm taking you to hospital now. And he was in the process of having stroke. How do we know if we're in the process of having stroke, Dr. Langlois?
Well, unfortunately, the biggest problem with stroke is that there's no pain. And, you know, everyone knows what a heart attack sounds like. And one of the big, everyone's heard of a heart attack. And that's because when you have chest pain, you immediately say, oh, my God, my chest hurts. And you go to the doctor or an emergency room, and it gets picked up more quickly. Because stroke is silent and that it doesn't cause pain, unless you have a hemorrhage, you can get a headache. It's often underdiagnosed, and people are a little bit less aggressive about getting their symptoms assessed. I mean, if someone has a little numbness in their lip or an occasional speech problem, or maybe their vision goes out for a brief second, there's a tendency to procrastinate and say, oh, that was weird or whatever, especially younger people. But it really, stroke, the warning signs are essentially small symptoms that mimic what the larger symptom would be. So you can lose sensory or motor function of your arm or leg or hand. You can get weakness of your face. You get slurring or missing speech. You can get visual disturbances that can be transient. So those are the warning signs, but they also can be actual strokes. If you can have people that they think, oh, that was nothing, and they have actually on their imaging studies, they can show evidence of a small stroke. And what's most important is not the fact that you've had one, but just to prevent you from having the type of stroke that will affect your life, your quality of life.
Mm. Now, is the small stroke you start off at, the mini stroke, is that the TIA? And explain that a little more, if you would.
You know, a TIA stands for transient ischemic attack, and it's thought to be a pre-stroke condition that lasts a short period of time, usually less than 24 hours is usually the definition of a TIA, where you have some sort of neurological complaint that reverses completely. There's also a thing called a RIND, R-I-N-D, which is a reversible ischemic neurological deficit, which is sort of a TIA that's a little bit worse. And then a frank stroke is one where you have a fixed problem. The truth is, a TIA, you might have these symptoms, but if you study people with TIAs, they could have evidence of a stroke on their MRI. It's just that the function that was subserved wasn't irreparably damaged. And the brain has a tremendous amount of plasticity and ability to sort of cure itself or heal itself. And so if you might have a deficit that's transient, but if you may have some real tissue damage, you just have enough redundancy in the function of the brain that you can overcome this smaller stroke. A reversible ischemic neurological deficit, tends to be maybe a little bit of a larger distribution of brain injury that, whether it reverses completely or not, can also result in evidence of ischemic change in the brain. And the MRI scans are really the best to pick these types of things up. When you're talking about a frank stroke, someone who has a real stroke, which is, you know, it's all probably a continuum of the same disease. When you have that's usually something that the symptom comes and just doesn't go away. And then when you study patients, either by CAT scan within about 8 hours, there start to be changes in CAT scan. MRI is a little bit more sensitive. But, you know, when you have a real stroke, these are picked up by, much more easily, and they're usually larger areas of the brain that's been affected. However, even if you can have a very small stroke in a very unique place and have a very large deficit, meaning that there are some parts of the brain where there are the geography isn't as bad, and you could have a big chunk of your brain missing and you wouldn't notice anything, whereas there are other places where it's, you know, the real estate's very expensive, where you can have a very, very small stroke and leave somebody, you know, more or less paralyzed or, you know, unable to take care of themselves. So the reason why there's some sort of variability is that it has to do with the volume of the brain that's affected, the location, the type of injury, and so they can result in these transient or permanent deficits. Just really, you know, it really depends on, you know, a combination of all these different factors.
Mm. I read over and over when I was doing my research for today's show that time is of the essence if you think you're experiencing a stroke, and that nearly one-fourth of strokes occur in people under the age of 65. I mean, there were people in their 20s and 30s. I kept coming across these stories. So let's look at some risk factors, and let's look at some medical conditions that might increase our risk factor for a stroke.
I think the three biggest ones that Americans are probably the most susceptible to are diabetes, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. You know, if we spent the amount of money on treating these three diseases, you know, education, diet, exercise, you know, these sorts of things, if we spent a fraction of the money that we spent on the treatment of stroke on, you know, prevention, we'd probably basically cure a lot more people of stroke, in all honesty. But, you know, these are tough problems. I mean, the people's diets, their exercise pattern, not to mention their, you know, genetic susceptibility to these things are, you know, commonly what can leave people, you know, susceptible to a stroke. I think diabetes in particular is really an endemic problem to our culture. High blood pressure, probably not too far behind. You know, cholesterol diseases are also associated with early risk of stroke. So, obviously, if you're a young person with any or all of those comorbidities, it sort of behooves you to essentially be as aggressive as possible by, you know, seeking a good internist who can manage your blood pressure, make sure you're on cholesterol-lowering medications, you know, try to maintain a healthy diet, and, you know, limit, if you are diabetic, obviously tight control of your blood glucose is very, very important. But, you know, the truth is some of those diseases we can't do anything about. They're things may be born with susceptibility or, you know, just genetically predisposed to develop them. But, you know, the number one problem in people that we can reverse is cigarette smoking. And you know, unfortunately, very often, some people have all four of these things. They have diabetes, they have high cholesterol, they have high blood pressure, and they smoke. And, you know, the risks of stroke, heart disease in patients like this is extraordinarily how much higher the risk is than for other person who doesn't have these risk factors. And so risk factor identification modification is critical.
I also read that as we get older, our risk increases as it does with many diseases, and that ethnicity also plays into that factor.
Yeah, well, black Americans have a higher risk of intracranial disease, meaning they'll have a higher risk of developing narrowing and occlusion of the blood vessels in their brain, while white Americans have a higher risk of extracranial disease, meaning blockage of vessels in their neck. It's just the genetic predisposition between, say, African Americans and whites. You know, Asians tend to have a lot less risk for any of these diseases, at least on an Asian type diet. Asians often will acquire the same risk as the longer they live in the United States because they're exposed to all the stuff that the Native American people, mm-hmm. quote unquote, expose themselves to. And then there, you know, Hispanics have a sort of a mixed picture. There's clearly genetic susceptibility, but we're all humans are susceptible to these risk factors if they exist. And it's uncommon for people to develop stroke who have none of these risk factors, especially young people. The majority of young patients who have strokes have some risk factor, or they have another type of stroke due to a trauma or a vessel disease called a dissection, which are sort of traumatic or irritations of the blood vessel themselves that don't necessarily carry the same risk profile, but they're much rarer. So as a young person, if you do have any or all these risk factors, then, you know, you're obviously you're going to increase the, you may be a 30 or 40 year old, but your blood vessels may look like a 50, a 60 or 70 year old.
Right. And then what about male versus female? Because in some studies I read that slightly more women have strokes than men. In others I read that it's fairly equal, but men have them tend to have them at a younger age. Is there any truth in that?
I think that's mixed. I mean, there are certainly a set of vascular diseases that women have a little bit of a less of a risk for. Probably estrogen has some protective effect on certain cholesterol-related diseases, but you know, in the end, I'm not aware of a major difference in the susceptibility to stroke. It's not enough that you say, "Oh, I'm a guy; I don't have to worry about this." There's no real benefit to that data, really, because you know, if you think you're not susceptible because you're one sex or another, I would argue that's sort of wishful thinking.
Okay, all right. So let's look at some treatment quickly. What can we expect from a medical point of view, Dr. Langlois?
Well, the treatment's really you're best treated before you ever develop a problem. This is clearly with this disease, it probably is more meaningful than anything else. You know, once patients come to me, you know, my practice, we deal with a lot of patients with essentially carotid disease or intracranial vascular disease that can be really, you know, arguably almost impossible to treat. So you don't want to get to a doctor once you've had your stroke if you can avoid it. You're sort of too late. I mean, we can do things to help people, but in general, we'd rather not see patients like this, and unfortunately, by the time they get to a neurosurgeon or an interventional neurologist or you know, someone who does actual treatment for stroke, it's they've lost an opportunity because they haven't taken care of their bodies for a number of years. So I can't emphasize enough of the concept of prevention and good health first. You know, and if there's listeners who are wondering if they're at risk, I mean, you know, see your internist, know what your medical history is, know what your family history is. If you have a family history of these diseases, you're probably a little bit of higher risk. You should have your cholesterol checked. You should have your make sure your blood glucose is checked. You want to try to exercise, good diet. So way before you ever get to me, hopefully you're, you know, doing that. And that's really the purpose of this, you know, conversation, in all honesty, because, you know, once you have your stroke, you're not going to think back, oh, I listened to that radio conversation, I really need to do this. You know, the goal is never to get there. But if you find yourself in an emergency room somebody's telling you you have a stroke, then, you know, knowing what the options are is helpful. The primary thing we do is open up blood vessels one way or the other, or provide new ways of getting blood to the brain. So it's every treatment directed to stroke is really, you know, one or the other. Either we're opening blocked arteries or we're providing new blood of the brain that either is not, that the brain's not getting or needs to get. That's sort of the way all of our therapies are designed around.
Sounds good. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment right now. What would you like to leave our listeners with? Any hope on new research? What would you like to leave our listeners with?
I think most important, my father had a stroke when I was young, and he was only 42, or he was 45, actually. You know, it's strokes are not just the person. They affect spouses, families, brothers. To live with someone with a stroke is when they have a significant one is one of the most profound experiences. And just, you know, some people think stroke is worse than dying in many ways. I personally feel I'm dealing in this business. I don't think there's any worse complication that you can give someone than causing a stroke. It's a tremendously devastating problem. It turns people inside out. It can affect your sense of self and your self-esteem. It can affect your, you know, livelihood, your ability to make a living, to do your job. It's a devastating thing. And being aware and really being seriously aware of what a problem it is, hopefully will encourage people to take the necessary prevention so that they don't, you know, end up thinking, you know, how do I deal with this problem now that I have one? And there's no question that prevention is absolutely, you know, it was an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In this case, it's absolutely true. And I think, unfortunately, people don't do these things. I wouldn't have a job if people didn't, you know, people were healthy, really.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But in the end, I certainly have seen many, many bad stories and horrible stories, and obviously some victories, too. But you have to prevent and take care of yourself. And I think that's the most important thing.
Well, great advice. Gave us some great information there in a very short period of time, and I really appreciate you being with us today. Listeners can find out more about Dr. David Langler at drdavidlangler.com, drdavidlangler.com, and, of course, he's a neurosurgeon at the Cushing Neuroscience Institute. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Vicky. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Bye.
And please stay with us. When we come back, we're going to take a more personal look at stroke and how it affects people with Steve Borstein. His book is called Different Strokes. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Whether you want to write for business, for pleasure, or for publication, there's writing that works and writing that doesn't. So stop procrastinating and start today. Sign up for Writing That Gets Results with Vicky St. Clair and put your words to work. Vicky is a multidisciplinary writer, author, and communications consultant, and in 4 hands-on workshop sessions can help you focus your thoughts, identify your market, create your outline, and find your voice. Call Vicky St. Clair for full details at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. or email info@conversationslive.net.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Tired of the insanity of other talk radio stations? Just click your radio knob and say, "There's no place like Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, as I said at the beginning of the show, February is American Heart Month, and since cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease are linked, we are beginning the show this month with, we're talking about stroke. We're dedicating the whole hour to stroke. And we, of course, talked with neurosurgeon Dr. David Langler in the first segment on the medical aspect of stroke. And now we're going to be joined by Steve Borstein. He is a stroke survivor, writer, and researcher. He's hosted a national radio show and appeared on The View. His latest book is called Different Strokes, an intimate memoir for stroke survivors, families, and caregivers. Steve Borstein, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vicki. I appreciate you having me.
Well, I was telling you during the break, this is a really great book. We always want to try and put the personal aspect of these situations out there because it can be such a debilitating situation for people. And this book is definitely inspiring while sharing a lot of really great information. But before we get to that, I want to just talk about you and life pre-stroke. You were a type A personality. You had several businesses you built to success with your wife, Barbara. You retired at the age of 46. You were skiing. You were body surfing. Tell us what life was like for you before your stroke.
Well, early on, about 6 years before, 7 years before, I had run a very high-end dry cleaners in Washington, D.C., and I'm a third-generation dry cleaner. I owned a clothing store before that, and I really wanted to get out and be helpful to more people than just the thousands that come to the dry cleaners that we deliver to or over the counter, and so I decided to write a book about it called The Ultimate Guide to Shopping and Caring for Clothing. And I'm not a fashionista. I can't give you any fashion information. I only know how to care for clothing and everything made of fabric. And I've won national stain removal contests, and I did go on The View. And so I had sold the dry cleaners to be able to write this book because I couldn't write after working 12, 15 hours a day. And so I wrote the book. It took about a year or so of nonstop writing and research. And then parlayed that into a career as the clothing doctor. So when I was 50, I moved to Boulder, Colorado from D.C. for a quality of life, good weather, skiing, and hiking, and all that healthy stuff. And that was what transpired. And I ultimately was skiing one day and got hit on the ski slope at Vail by, I'm going to guess, a 200-pound-plus snowboarder or something. He didn't stop. Mm-hmm. He or she did not stop after they hit me. And when I woke up from my concussion, 30 seconds or a minute later, I had a dislocated shoulder, a cracked ribs, a concussion, floater in my left eye. And ultimately, what I didn't know at that time, even though I took the toboggan ride down and was x-rayed and all that, is that I probably whiplashed my neck, which probably tore the carotid artery on my right side, that eventually formed a flap, a clot, and hence the eventual stroke.
And here, this is what surprised me when I read your book, because your book is memoir, and it's also, you also included 20 interviews with survivors and caregivers who've gone through the stroke experience. And what really surprised me when I read your story and several of the stories in the book is that how many strokes were caused by accident, by trauma.
Right. Trauma, physical activity, sports, and that is true. And actually, as I finally got my wits about me and got my life back together after the stroke, which it's 3.5 years ago and I'm still working on it, but what I realized through my research in the last 6 or so months after my book came out in November and talking to stroke coordinators and nurses and therapists across the country, coast to coast, is that a huge number of people, not just young people or not just old people, but everybody in between, has experienced a stroke or a dissection of a tear in an artery due to physical activity. And while it's true, Vicki, that you can have that kind of problem from a genetic disposition where arteries just dissect spontaneously, or you might be a heavy smoker or high cholesterol, diabetic, whatever the trigger is, there seems to be a growing number of dissections from stroke and physical activity.
Mm. So I want to talk about what led up to your actual stroke, because you had several TIAs. You weren't really knowing that's what was going on at the time. Just walk us through that process, if you would, Steve, because
sure.
The whole idea here is, you know, just to make people more aware.
Right. It's much easier in retrospect, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And people ask me, how did you write with such clarity and specific knowledge when the stroke was, you know, you had it 1.5 years before you started writing the book? And it's because every act of it is burned into my brain. I just, for some reason, while I can't remember anyone's phone number anymore, and my short-term memory is really in the toilet, I can remember specific things very, very clearly. So about 2 weeks before my stroke, I went skiing once, and it was pretty terrifying to be back on the slope and always looking for people that might hit me, and I was stiff, and because I was just recovering from the rib damage and the dislocated shoulder and my whole psyche and all that, even though I'm a lifetime skier. And so I was out once, then I went to an exercise class, one that I've taken many times, and they were working specifically on neck rotation. And so they had us like face a mirror or face away from the mirror and then try and turn your whole body toward the mirror, like 180, to stretch out that area. And the class was great. It was pretty tough, but I thought it really helped loosen me up to get ready to ski. And I went up to Vail area and Snowmass and near Aspen to ski for a few days with friends. And I came off the ski slope the second day with a massive headache. And I didn't know what it was from. I just knew that I didn't feel well. My stomach was out of sorts. And so I drove back to Boulder early. And over the period of about 5 or 6 days leading up to that, I had had mini strokes, or TIAs, as they call them, trans ischemic attacks. And I really didn't see the symptoms or the signals. And that's one of the reasons that I advocate, one of the reasons I wrote the book, one of the reasons I advocate full time now for awareness, is that if I had seen the signals, I would have found myself to the hospital much faster. But it took me 5 TIAs, which were my left arm became numb and somewhat gimpy. I had a massive headache that came on real fast and furious. And then everything, the tingling, the numbness, the inability to raise my arm a little bit, all that stuff, and the headache dissipated within 15 or 20 minutes. And so I, you know, I was confused. I figured that the numbness and inability in my left arm was due to the dislocation and the nerve damage that I had. I figured the headache was something associated with migraines because I've had them before, even though the symptoms were slightly different. And so I just didn't see the signals. And finally, on the fifth one, when I was, or fourth one, I was driving back from Denver, and I got lost for an hour and a half, and I was disoriented. I finally got home, and I said to my wife, you know, I think there's something really wrong with me. You need to take me to the ER now. And so I got there, and then they started, you know, diagnosing what might be the problem.
Yeah, and this happened in the stories that you shared in the book. This happened over and over again with people. They didn't know what was happening. You, as you said, put it down to a pinched nerve many times because the symptoms dissipated so quickly. Now, I understand you had an MRI and at the hospital, and they were ready to discharge you. You were standing there with your papers, your release papers in hand, when a phone call came through and said, wait a minute, tell us about that.
That's true. I had spent a really interesting, you know, couple hours there waiting to find out what my future was, but they just couldn't nail it down, and so I was at the nurse's station checking out, so to speak, and the call came in from radiology that a second radiologist had read my brain scan and said, tell him to stop. He can't go home. We found something. And so it was like the stay of execution from the governor, but in reverse. Instead of getting off, I had to stay. And then the doc and the neurologist, radiologist, doc on duty all came in. They told me that they found these clots in my brain. The first radiologist had missed it, which is why they have a second read it, and which I always recommend. And they said, you can't go home. And they put me on blood thinners. And then I waited the night to decide whether I was going to get a stent put in, which is a pretty typical procedure to open up the carotid artery and block and put the clot that was in there back into the wall of the artery, or if they would put me in ICU for a week or 10 days on Coumadin, a very heavy blood thinner, to watch me. And if I should have a stroke, they would try and bring me down from it, but there was no guarantees. And the other thing is you have to stay on Coumadin for a year at least afterwards. And so it makes you very susceptible to bleeding and external injuries, and you can't do a lot of physical stuff, and I am a physical person. So my wife and I chose the stent and assumed that that would be the right and prudent decision.
Mm. Now, let's talk a little about what it was like for you when you came out of a hospital. As you said, you were a pretty fit, athletic kind of guy, used to, you know, going out and doing things. Emotionally, what was that like for you when you came home and realized, hey, this is going to be a whole different experience?
Well, I had my first realization in the ICU when I woke up there after they had sedated me after recovery because I had a massive headache. And I woke up and I kind of looked around. I saw these people hooked up to machines in other rooms, and I'd never been in ICU myself. And I just kind of started surveying myself, and I really didn't realize exactly what was going on until one of the therapists came in for my first PT, which was literally, you know, what, 7 or 8 hours after my stroke or something, and which I was very glad of. And there were some almonds sitting on a tray in front of me, and he said, you know, can you pick up the almond and one of the almonds for me? And my whole body was stroked, but it was a right side carotid and a left side paralysis. So my right side was still working, although it wasn't very coordinated, and I was just kind of out of it completely. But he says, can you pick up the almond? And I kind of laughed and said, of course I can pick up an almond. And he said, with your left hand. And I said, yeah, I understand. And I went to motion to do that, and I realized that my arm was like broken or a tree trunk. It didn't have any relationship to my body. And it hovered. I could move my arm a little bit, but not my fingers. They were in a claw, which is typical of paralysis. And I kind of tried to swoop it down to pick up an almond, and I couldn't do that. I really couldn't do anything with my left arm.
Right, right.
So in essence, he said, Steve, you'll get better, don't worry, and whatever. But when he left, you know, I kind of took stock of everything, and I said, well, okay, this sucks, but, you know, I have to get better, because that's the way it is, and I'm not going to sit around here and do nothing. And I had always wondered in my life, well, not always, but I have on occasion wondered what I would do and how I would react should I ever have a disease, cancer, something. I never thought about stroke. And I had already decided that I would be brave and I would work my tail off to get better. And so right there, that moment, 7 hours after coming out of recovery, I had made that decision, and that's the way it was.
Mm. You say you had to write this book. You wrote this book because you had to. It is an inspirational book because you do share how people have survived and, you know, how they've made their lives better despite what's happened. I was looking at a couple of the stories in there. You know, there's a 30-year-old Dina, for example. She knew exactly what was happening, and I think she was at an exercise class when this was happening. What did you learn from listening to the people who shared their stories with you?
Well, I learned so much, honestly, because every stroke, to some degree, is similar. When stroke survivors get together, whether it's in stroke support groups, which I'm working on around the country, or they meet in a social situation, there's always this immediate bond and 100% acceptance of where we were, where we came from, where we are today. And so it becomes a really easy thing to speak. But what I learned was that while we all have similarities, strokes can differ in many ways, severity of physical attributes or deficits, mental deficits from like aphasia, not being able to speak or come up with the word to speak with or not being able to speak at all, or other cognitive issues where you can't speak to people properly or walk into a room and remember to turn the water off or turn the flame of your stove off or something like that before you leave, and that all of these things are open season. So we stroke survivors can have anything from, you know, zero deficits all the way up to a lot of deficits. And so I learned that while I consider myself very fortunate to have, one, survived, and two, to come back to where I am today, I never had a problem speaking exactly. And the doctor was really happy when I said, I have a terrible headache. And I thought I was just telling her some news and she was going to help me, but she was super relieved that I could speak. She didn't care what I said. And, you know, some people that have, in my book, you will see that some of those people, more than one, could only speak curse words after their stroke. They're these innocent people, and they say, you know, why is that? Why are those the only words I know? But I learned that people, most of us are survivors, and most people fight to get back normality. But more specifically, the life-changing experiences cannot be denied. And one that I have learned twice, I didn't learn well enough from reading the stories that I wrote and that I interviewed all these people. They were very in-depth interviews and got edited down a bit so they wouldn't take up the whole book, but they were 50,000 words, is that things happen. Like, for instance, we lose friends. We don't know exactly how to filter what we say. And I have lost two friends, my closest friend, and another friend that I've known for 40 years, and both of them, we have no relationship anymore. Because of something that I said. I didn't mean to say it, and I didn't mean to say it in a way that they would be offended, but and they didn't cut me any slack for the fact that I had a brain attack, and that, you know, I don't want to say that, hey, you know, I'm a stroke survivor, you know, give me a break, because, you know, whatever. But the fact is that there are so many life-changing experiences that are both good and bad, that come from stroke. And I was so inspired by these people that I interviewed and some of their caregivers, and the way that the spouses, you know, said, I can't live with him anymore. I can't sleep with him anymore because he can't move his body properly when he lays next to me, or he puts his 200 pounds on top of me and he doesn't even know. So there not being able to tell your teenage child whether to go left or right at the light anymore. They don't know who the patriarch is or the matriarch of the family. And it affects everybody. And you're right. What you said is that it affects more than that person. It affects everyone that's associated with you, family, friends, loved ones.
Yeah. Well, this was a common theme throughout the book. And you say in your section that you and your wife, Barbara, have been married nearly 30 years. You're almost one person. Yet there was no way she could understand the fog in your brain. And this was a really common theme amongst other people. I'm thinking of Kathy, who was 24 and a scientist, and she had a stroke. And she, you know, her husband was just 27 at the time. And she said, no matter how good he is, he just will never understand what it's like to have that stroke.
Yeah, her husband, by the way, wrote one of the blurbs on the back of the book because he was just so insightful and really had it, because she had two strokes, one at 22 and one at 24, because they still hadn't found out why she had her first stroke. But he said, it's like, I'll put it this way. When you have two computers that are trying to communicate and they lock in and they connect. And he said, that's the way that we were. And now the computers don't exactly connect anymore, but we do connect at times. And that's so true. It really, it's all over the map what happens to people. But I think that when you were talking about Dina, for instance, who was 33 when she had her stroke, she was a nurse or a physical therapist. So when she was in Pilates class and she had the symptoms, she was completely shut down, and she didn't know, she wasn't sure what was going on with her. But when they drove her to the hospital in the ambulance, she heard them calling in and saying, we have a 33-year-old stroke here. And she was like freaked out because she said, I'm having a stroke, yet she couldn't move any of her body. So, one of the things I did want to share about what you said is that, because I think it's important that people understand about stroke survivors, and I learned so much about people with disabilities and deficits. I mean, I've always, had an open heart, and my mother used to work with disabled kids when she was younger, and I would go along and help when I was a kid. But what I really learned was that it's so important that people understand what stroke survivors are about, which is, again, one of the reasons that I wrote it. But it's like a stroke survivor can stand in front of you and speak to you and stand and appear to be, quote, normal. And the fact is that same person that appears to be normal can't remember their phone number, can't hold a job, and can't find their way home six blocks. So you have to remember that a lot of times strokes, if you're not physically disabled, people say, oh, well, you seem to be fine. But it's because they don't understand the fog that goes on inside of our brain. And that is, in essence, the complexity of brain attack and stroke. It's just you don't know what's going on in your brain. And my wife couldn't know. Right. Kathy's husband couldn't know. And so we all try to articulate it.
Right. Well, there are some great inspiring stories in this book. If you're caring for someone with a stroke or you have a stroke yourself, I'd highly recommend it. It's definitely the most interesting book I've read. It really sheds some personal light on what it's really like for people. It's called Different Strokes, an intimate memoir for stroke survivors, families and caregivers. You can find out more about Steve Borstein at survivingstroke.com, survivingstroke.com. Lots more questions I'd love to ask you, Steve, but we're right out of time, so I have to let you go. I thank you
That's
for being
okay.
With...
I'm gonna assume that Dr. Langler talked about the symptoms of stroke. And
absolutely,
such.
Absolutely.
But Vicki, thank you for allowing me the time to share information about stroke. People can write me through the website directly. I will answer their emails. They can even call me.
Great.
All I want to do is help.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Vicki.
And please stay with us. We'll be joined by Dr. Dan Roberts as soon as we get back.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425 425- 787-287-2500.
February is American Heart Month, and coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Dr. Victoria Bowman and Dr. Robert Davidson share how to boost your immune system and keep your heart healthy. Cardiologist Dr. Davidson will also review the latest research and what that really means to you and your health. Tune in next week and every Monday to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See guest information and podcasts at conversationslive.net.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no, LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Whether you want to write for business, for pleasure, or for publication, there's writing that works and writing that doesn't. So stop procrastinating and start today. Sign up for Writing That Gets Results with Vicki St. Clair and put your words to work. Vicki is a multidisciplinary writer, author, and communications consultant, and in 4 hands-on workshop sessions can help you focus your thoughts, identify your market, create your outline, and find your voice. Call Vicki St. Clair for full details at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or email info@conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we just have a few minutes left of today's show. We've dedicated the whole hour to stroke and what that means medically, what that means to survivors. And now we're going to talk with a licensed psychologist, neuropsychologist, and board certified in both health and sports psychologist, Dr. Diane Roberts-Stoller. She works with individuals and organizations worldwide to help them find solutions and resources to overcome life's challenges and reach their goals. She is a survivor of stroke and also 4 traumatic brain injuries. And she's the author of Coping with Mild Traumatic Brain Injury, a guide to living with the challenges associated with concussion and brain injury. And Dr. Diane, as she's known, is joining us today to talk about neuropsychology and how that can maybe help a stroke survivor. So, Dr. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Vicki. I really appreciate this time. As your other people on the show, I am very, very passionate about helping others like myself to recover.
Yeah, you are a stroke survivor. You've also, as I said, had
I had a cavernous hemangioma, which was a bundle of capillaries that so it bled out while I was driving, and then I had a 60-mile-an-hour head-on. Yes.
Yeah, how terrifying. And you know what? When I was reading Steve's book, the previous guest, there were several people who had a stroke while they were driving and or got pulled over by police asking them if they were drunk.
Right.
So I want to ask you, what is a neuropsychologist? Let's begin there.
Well, there's 2 types of neuropsychologists, and I've been both. One is the type that where you would go to get a paper and pencil test to evaluate your cognitive skills, your behaviors, your psychological, to see where you were compared to others. So it gives you a norm. It's there's specific tests that looks at your attention, that looks at your recall, your memory, your motor. When he was talking about being able to move something and you can't, sequencing, how you handle lights. So it is usually, you meet with the neuropsychologist, it's usually an 8-hour test, and then they give you a follow-up, and it is covered by usually 99 to 100% of all insurance carriers.
Mm. Now,
so that's very important.
Very important. Gosh, yes,
the
very important.
The second type is also what does similar things, but my way of evaluating, I used to do that, is also there is, as I'm sure you've heard of, you know, the MRIs and the CAT scans, but there's a test that can actually evaluate how your brain is functioning, such as a functional MRI or SPECT scan. What we do here is a quantitative EEG, or called QEEG, and we actually map the brain and assess where the brain is functioning or not functioning, and then looking at the vascular system and also the electrical system and the nutritional system, we figure out where the brain is functioning, not, and then we work that way. So both of these, especially if someone's had a stroke, as you said, in an auto accident, these two tests, these two different types of tests, do hold up in a court of law to evaluate the functioning of that person. That's the key, versus the structural damage, which an MRI does.
Right, right. Now, yeah. I understand neuropsychologists, of course, to incorporate all of this, have extensive training in anatomy, physiology, and the pathology of the nervous system. So typically, and I know, Dr. Diane, that it's going to vary depending on each individual patient, but typically, how do you start working with someone to help them? You talked about mapping their brain to their activities.
Right. Is that they would come in, and if you go in and you actually put 19 electrodes on the brain, we have them sit quietly with their eyes open for like 5 to 10 minutes, and then their eyes closed, and we're looking at the electrical system and how the brain waves are looking. And then it is put against a normative database and actually shows if a certain area is not functioning well or not. And then based on that, we can do protocols. Like he mentioned a specific of not remembering.
Mm-hmm.
I took me 7 years to learn to walk and talk again.
Wow.
And is that then, excuse me, I didn't expect someone coming in.
That's okay. This happens. So what was it? You just mentioned that it took you 7 years to get back. But what kept you going during that time? Because I know depression affects a lot of people.
As a matter of fact, in my book, I have a whole chapter on grieving the loss of self. And it is very hard. And to having support of family or someone was my mentor. I love sharing the story that I had lost my psychology practice. I was not a wife. I was not a mother. I had three little kids at the time. And I just felt so despondent. And I called him up one day and I said, I can't do anything. And he said, but you called me. I said, no, that's nothing. And he says, can you move your big toe? And I said, yeah. And he says, see, you can do something. And it's that moment of someone giving you encouragement.
Right.
That you could do something. And I was blessed to find the water therapy by Igor Berdenko, who's in Massachusetts, but he has trained people throughout the country in water therapy. And water allows buoyancy to people to gain the vestibular movement and helping the brain heal. I knew about nutrition at the time, and so that's when I started putting the integrative approach together, that with the neurofeedback, with water therapy, cranial sacral is a wonderful method. It's part of a physical therapy that really helps the brain to heal. And, you know, getting out and taking that, you can't always take a walk because of the paralysis. I could not use my entire right side.
Mm-hmm.
And is that, and I could hold a pen, but I couldn't write. And going into the water, that allows this wonderful ability to start integrating and allowing the brain. And the key, which is important, is to for your listeners to know of neuroplasticity. The brain can heal.
The brain.
Absolutely. The vascular system. In my case, I had to have brain surgery to remove the growth. And it actually has been all rewired. You know, and as I said, obviously I'm talking to you now and not halted. And not having the word finding, and this is the methods I'm telling you about of cognitive rehab. We have a cognitive rehab person here.
All right. I'm sorry, I have to cut you off because we're right at the end of our show. But
okay.
You've given us some great information. Now I know what a neuropsychologist is and how that can help people with stroke symptoms.
Absolutely.
So I do appreciate you being with us today. I want to let listeners know that they can find out more about Dr. Diane at drdiane.com, drdiane.com. And if you missed any of that interview, this will be on podcast on the site, conversationslive.net, by tomorrow. Dr. Diane Roberts-Stoller, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, and thank you so much, Vicki.
I also want to let you know that Dr. Diane has written a book called Coping with Mild Traumatic Brain Injury. And very quick, if you missed the one gathering, it's going to be this Saturday. They had to reschedule it because of the snow. February 11th, 12th, you can find out more at theonegathering.com. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.